I'm Harry Burns, Director of Public Health for the Health Board, and I am Dr. Sisyphus. And the lesson from Phil's story about Dr. Sisyphus is that if you always do what you've always done, don't be surprised if what you get is what you got yesterday and the day before that. And if only Dr. Sisyphus had put a couple of pebbles in his pocket so that he could jam them under the stone and have a wee break for lunch and go on again and so on, it would all have been over in the first day. And one of the things that was important to us in pulling the centre together was to get new people and new ideas in. Many, many friends in this room have worked together for a decade or more in trying to tackle health and health inequalities in Glasgow. And we've all shared the same frustrations. And one of the key passions behind the centre was to try and get new people who hadn't approached this problem before. And I'm really encouraged, for example, to see two professors of biochemistry in this room who a year ago wouldn't necessarily have been part of this debate. So the new thinking was really important. Now, one of the key drivers behind wanting to get new people and new disciplines involved in the health inequalities debate was a perception that happiness, macroeconomic policy, housing policy were important on the one hand, and at the other end, many of us, and a great deal of money was spent in the city dealing with cancer, heart disease and stroke. Huge big societal solutions being offered what is essentially a molecular problem, or even submolecular, because in fact it's electrons firing off bursts of energy that damage your DNA that produce cancer. It's not microeconomic policy that produces cancer. There's a long chain of coincidences and events that lead from one to the other. And to try and establish where some of the leverage points there were in that chain of events to be able to influence them, we felt it was important to try and bring people together to link these two things. And the timing of today couldn't have been better, because I guess for many of you, yesterday on the news was probably the first time you'd ever heard of telomeres. Okay, the story that was released from The Lancet yesterday about telomere length in twins who had obesity or who were smokers. And the argument went that if these scientists took twins, one of whom would be obese or would be a smoker or whatever, and they measured the lengths of telomeres in these sets of twins. Now, what telomeres do is really very clever. Telomeres keep your DNA intact. Think of them as little sewing machines or little zip fasteners, because they exist on the end of chromosomes, and whenever your chromosomes split in order for the cell to divide, that strand of DNA is at great risk. And what the telomere does is it zips along the DNA and it looks for breakages and it repairs the breakages. It carries wee fragments of DNA with it and it just slots them in. And so it keeps the cell healthy, but at a cost to itself, because the telomere shortens the more repairs it has to make to the DNA. And what these scientists yesterday were describing was the fact that obesity and cigarette smoking damages DNA at a molecular level. And you can measure the extent of that damage through measuring the length of telomeres. And what they showed was that there was a 5 to 10 year impact of obesity and smoking. And people who smoked or who were obese were biologically 10 years older than people who didn't smoke. Now, that's not the first time telomeres have become important to us in the centre, because last Christmas, another study looking at telomere length was published from San Francisco. And what these researchers did was they looked at women who were stressed, by and large middle-class women, because in truth the Americans don't have a system for measuring social class and they just assume that everyone's middle-class. By and large, these women were selected on the basis of having to look after chronically ill children. And they compared telomere length in women who were stressed by looking after these chronically ill children with telomere length in women who were unstressed in that way. And lo and behold, the telomeres in the stressed women were 10 years shorter than telomere length in the unstressed women. Different kind of stress from obesity and cigarette smoking, but the same molecular impact. So when I read that, and this is my story, I guess, when I read that, I got on the phone to colleagues and who knew more about molecular biology than I did and said, is there anyone in Glasgow that knows anything about telomeres? And I was pointed to a young researcher who works in a transplant laboratory. And what he's interested in is measuring the age of transplanted organs. Because one reason for failure of transplanted organs is they age more rapidly when they're implanted into a donor. And I phoned him up and he said, yeah, I know all about this. Come and we'll talk. And he showed me a fascinating set of photographs on his computer. He showed me photographs of his great-great-great-grandmother, who in the 1860s and 1870s worked as a domestic servant on an estate in County Mayo in Ireland for a man called Captain Charles Boycott. And Captain Boycott was obviously everything that is bad about English imperialism, if you like, inasmuch as he ruled his servants with a rod of iron, and one of the things he required of them was that they should all get annual photographs. So this guy had a series of photographs of his great-great-great-granny over the period of the famines in Ireland. And it was astonishing to see how rapidly she aged, from being an attractive young woman to within 10 years looking like a very, very old, haggard lady. And he said, yeah, and you know something? I've been measuring telomere length in women in Glasgow for the past few months because we've been interested in a particular condition. And knowing about this study on stressed women in San Francisco, I've graded them into socioeconomic status. Look, he said, telomere length in women from deprived parts of Glasgow are about 10 years shorter than telomere length from women in affluent parts of Glasgow. People living in conditions of socioeconomic poverty look old because biologically they are old. People who come from deprived parts of Glasgow die by and large of the same things that people from affluent parts of Glasgow die of. They only do so 10 to 15 years earlier. And they die 10 to 15 years earlier because they're aging faster. And Graham Watt, who is here, first coined the expression that Glaswegians have more miles on the clock than similarly aged Edinburgh citizens. And we have evidence that this is a direct biological effect. Now, where does that leave us in terms of thinking about the way ahead? Well, there are two approaches that we can adopt here, and I want to try and provoke a bit of a response. There's the approach of trying to work out what is it about social circumstances that lead to DNA being damaged in this way by free radicals. Is it just a question of the fact that people in the East End eat too much and become obese and smoke too much and develop that kind of stress? Or are the stresses that we're seeing in the East End like the San Francisco stress, the stress of looking after a chronically ill child? Because I don't think that stress is materially much different from the stress of having a child who's addicted to drugs, or the stress of having a child who's in Barlinnie, or the stress of having to live in social circumstances where the civic conversation of our age is about how good a consumer are you. And if you don't have any money, you can't participate in that civic conversation and therefore you are socially stressed in the same way that the San Franciscans who look after a chronically ill child are stressed. And we're about to embark on a study that will give us the answers to these questions, and hopefully by the end of the summer there'll be some publicity about that. That study may well give us some of the psychosocial interventions that we need that can help people living in these circumstances. It will give us powerful ammunition to argue for policies that will help them. But there's another end to this, because these are molecular events that are taking place, and there may be molecular solutions. And this is a very interesting place to have this meeting, because in 1911, the MP for Glasgow Central, which is just was exactly here at that time, engaged in a debate with one of my predecessors as Medical Officer of Health on the cures for tuberculosis. Dr. Chalmers, the MOH, argued strongly that unless an attack was made on tuberculosis through changing housing conditions in the city, the way he put it is, time will be lost and disappointment will result. He had definite evidence that overcrowded housing led to death from TB. And we didn't change the housing conditions. What happened was the MPs argued for TB sanatoria. And Glasgow got hospitals when what it needed was houses, and we're only now getting to the end of closing Victorian hospitals, many of which were built in a false attempt to tackle a condition for which there was no cure. But imagine in 1911, where we have a condition that is killing thousands. We have a definite social cause or a definite social contribution to that condition. But imagine streptomycin had been available in 1911. Would we have withheld streptomycin from TB victims because actually the basic problems were social and we really should change the social conditions? No, we wouldn't. We would have given them the streptomycin and we would have argued to change the social conditions. So to use Phil's famous phrase, it all matters. And one of the points that I would want to make to you is that we have tended to write off the medical model of this. Well, just because it's a medical model doesn't make it a bad one. It's part of the solution. And in talking to my colleague at the Western, who's researching how to stop transplanted kidneys from aging, says, well, there are lots of ways in which we can slow this process down. Folic acid does that. Selenium does that. And these are all normal constituents of food, fruit, vegetables, etc. And it brings us back to the whole cycle of intervention that we can bring to bear here. And what's emerging in the first year's work of this centre, from my point of view, is that we are very, very close to doing something that no city, no system has ever done before, which is pull together an explanation why major social policies can lead to submolecular events in cells that kill people 10 to 15 years earlier. And I would like to think that distinctive Glasgow response to this would be to say, let's do it all. Let's organise our health service so that we can tackle things. Let's organise our schooling system so that we bring productive, happy children in control of their lives into the society. Let's organise our whole civic ethos into one that Anthony Grayling described as one where people were engaged and supportive and natural in the responses to these problems. So I'd like to encourage you to think very broadly outside silos in all of this, and to see that we all, whether we're professors of biochemistry or social policy analysts or whatever, have a solution to the problems of the East End of Glasgow. So next is Andrew. Most of you know Andrew. I mean, Andrew is a cyclist extraordinary. He and I have cycled in many strange places in the world. But Andrew's ambition is to start the second Enlightenment in Scotland. And if anyone can do it, he can.
Thanks very much, Harry. I'm going to talk about two sets of ideas that came up in the seminar series that really excited me. And they're ideas that were introduced to us by Sholem Glauberman from Canada. Sholem's got the best job title I've ever heard. He is the philosopher in residence at the Baycrest Geriatric Home. So I've let my family know when the time comes, send me there. That'll be fine. I like that. And the second set are from a colleague of mine, Maureen O'Hara, who's a humanist psychologist. She runs a postgraduate centre in San Francisco. So I'm going to run through those. I'm going to go at a canter because we're running a wee bit late. But basically, Sholem gave us three sets of ideas. I'm just going to talk about one set of ideas. And that is, the basic idea that he gave us was that there is a link between the ideas that we have about creation and the underlying state of the universe and how we approach life. Okay, so those great big things affect what we do every day, is his idea. And if you kind of look at how that works, he's saying, well, especially important is whether we think the universe is inherently ordered or inherently chaotic. And so if you go back to, say, the ancient times, you know, Sir Phil earlier on was talking about Greece, and these ideas of Sholem's are largely Western and largely male, so I'll put that up for people to knock down too if they want. But you know, the ancients thought that the real world was inherently ordered. The medievals thought that, well, only God can know order, and the way in which you show that you're saved or not saved is behaving as if you know God's purpose. So I'll come back to that in a wee minute as well. But then in the modern world, where we are now, we as humans began to say, well, not only God can know this, we can know it too. So we'll apply science and it's possible for us to know everything. And since about the 18th century, since the Enlightenment, we've been behaving as if that's true, as if it is possible for us to know everything. We just have to keep applying our disciplines until we know everything. And I think that idea is beginning to run out of steam. For me it is anyway, I'll come back to that in a moment. So what's that got to do with health? Well, the kind of thing that I think has got to do with health is, well, if you look at the ancients, I mean, what they said was, well, the universe is inherently ordered. So if you get sick, you're out of order, as it were, and what you have to do is rebalance. So, you know, all that stuff about galens, hot, cold, wet, dry, different kinds of bile, summer, winter, all that stuff that's in textbooks, it comes from that time, and what we had to do was kind of rebalance those things. In the medieval period, when you know it's God's order in the universe, there is no sickness and there is no aging. You know, the metaphor, if you like, is the Garden of Eden. And if you think that's a bit wacky, then think about the WHO definition of health. It reflects an Edenic, a complete state of social, mental, and physical well-being. So they're kind of trying to get us back into the Garden of Eden by this reckoning. And then, you know, there's a third metaphor around the time of the 18th century where, of the body as a chemical processor. So illness is when your chemicals get out of balance and what you have to do is put your chemicals back into balance. And of course, the metaphor for our age, I'm sure you're all aware, that we live with all the time is the smooth running machine. And what you do with interventions is you intervene either surgically or chemically to kind of get the machine to run properly. You know, I think those ideas have been very influential. I'm not saying they're the right ideas. A lot of those ideas I don't like, but I think they've been extraordinarily influential in affecting how we go about doing things. And if you think just about the time from the Enlightenment, so around the 1750s through to now, and think about successive waves of the appliance of science and materialist ideas in the 19th century and so on, then you can begin to see that you know those begin to affect, you know, the introduction of reservoirs, germ theories of disease, nursing and health visitors, risk, lifestyle, behaviour, all come from those sets of ideas. And whilst I think they've still got some power, you would have great difficulty convincing me that what we need to do now is build another reservoir in order to improve public health. So what I'm saying is we need to find the 21st century equivalent of that public health effort in the 19th century. What is the 21st century equivalent of building a reservoir? I don't know what that is, but that's the question that came out of that for me. And I think we're now at a turning point. So these ideas are running out of steam. When we find the 21st century equivalent of the reservoir, we're not going to close the reservoirs down. We'll still need them. We still need all of that, but it's not sufficient now to help us tackle the intractable problems of our age. We need to kind of do things in a different way, is what I would argue. So I think we're at a kind of a turning point or a tipping point, that kind of language is what we need to use. And that turns me to Maureen's ideas. And, you know, if we accept now that we're living in a time of change, complexity and uncertainty as the characteristics of the age that we live in, then what kind of responses can we elicit to that when we're trying to improve health? And Maureen gave us three ideas. She said, well, when you're faced with change, you can be neurotic about it. And what is that? Well, what you do is you make the boundaries, you control them more fully, you stiffen the boundaries up, things are okay really, you just have to tidy up a wee bit. You develop a them and us mentality, which has come up this morning already, so I want you to think about them and us as a kind of neuroticism. And the stories are competing stories, so it's their story or our story, it's science or social policy, it's Islam or Christianity, whatever the fundamentalisms happen to be. And the games that we play are win games, lose games. We'll get them before they get us. I'm having the money, you're not getting any, and so on and so forth. The second idea that she gave us was the descent into chaos or the psychotic response to change. And that's characterised in Maureen's thinking by instability. Where things change, restructure all the time, and so on and so forth. Or nothing matters, you just kind of give up, there's a kind of nihilism, you descend into despair. Or you can have violent responses, reactionary responses, and the games are lose-lose. If I can't have it, you're not getting it either. That kind of response. And that's characterised by no coherent story at all. A state of storylessness. Okay, there's no coherent story. We can't make meaning out of psychosis. And the third kind of thing that Maureen talked to us about was a kind of transformative response. You know, how do we respond to change in a way that just accepts that it's happening, and we try to grapple it with it and make it happen in ways that give us the kinds of things that we want rather than the kinds of things that we don't want, where we can have multiple stories that don't conflict with each other, but just part of the diversity that we live with. The natural world always diversifies to survive. We always homogenise to survive. It's a bit crazy. How do we encourage self-organisation? How do we live with what it is that other people want to do? How do we support that? How do we create the enabling conditions for that? So the question that I'm left with is, if a story is a narrative which connects human beings to the natural world and to creation, why are we here? What are we all about? And if the enactment of a story is to act as if to make that story true, and a culture as a group of people enacting a story, then what is our story about health? What is it that we want to do in order to improve health in Glasgow? And what view of the world is that based on? That's my summary. And I'm going to hand over to Carol now.
Okay. Thank you, Andrew. I'm kind of aware of the number of ideas that have been thrown out, and so I think, given time and so on, my task is probably to try and simplify what I was intending to say. I've had a long-standing interest in the relationship between environment and behaviour. What are the factors that influence how we behave, and how does our behaviour vary in different sorts of circumstances and environments? A number of ideas from the seminar series have got something to say about this, and I wanted to say a bit about a seminar led by Alistair Lawrence, which talked to us a bit about how the behaviour of animals changes when you put them in very intensified environments. And he reminded us, of course, very strongly of the genetic basis for behaviour in animals. And so there are examples, of course, where different species of animals have been bred for particular characteristics. We see that in dogs. So Dobermans have been bred particularly for their aggressiveness, not just their general aggressiveness, but their aggressiveness particularly towards humans. We also heard about species of vole, which look morphologically identical. But one species, the prairie vole, is habitually sexually monogamous. The other species, the meadow vole, is much more gregarious, and the particular genetic sequence that led to these different behaviours was identified, injected into the other species, and lo and behold, their behaviour changed. So we're reminded of the genetic basis of behaviour, and when we bring this to humans, of course, at one level we're not that much different. And the nature versus nurture debate, I think, is now thankfully behind us, and Matt Ridley's idea of nature via nurture is now the one that is accepted. So, for example, we understand that a lot of the ways that humans behave are universal human traits. They do have a genetic basis, but the expression of them can be influenced by some of the things we put in our environment. So as parents, the behaviour of our children is very strongly determined by the genetic basis that we give our children, but we can modify that through different types of parenting skills. And that then, of course, makes you think, with all of this work on the human genome and so on, if only we understood exactly what genes were responsible for what behaviours, and if only we understood exactly what sorts of nurturing environments could make those genes be expressed in different ways, then we would know exactly what to do in terms of improving the health of Scotland and Glasgow, because we would be able to understand why people behave in particular ways, and we would also know how to modify those behaviours. That, of course, is at one level some kind of nirvana. The other level is completely unrealistic. And Sholem Glauberman talked to us about Laplace's demon. Laplace being someone who truly believed that if we understood all of the laws of nature and we had all of the information we needed at our fingertips, we would be able both to interpret everything that's gone before us and predict everything that would happen in the future. Laplace was given a job by Napoleon as Minister for the Interior. He survived in that job for the vast length of time of 6 weeks, because he kept wanting to reduce everything that happened to a series of predictable events. And so I wonder, how do we deal with unpredictability? As the Centre for Population Health, we're embarked, I think, on twin tracks. We are embarked on a track which tries to gather more and more information to help us understand health in Glasgow and the determinants of health in Glasgow, and we keep trying to add to that information and modify it and test it out and compare it with other places. But yet at the same time, we know that that information isn't going to give us the answers for what we've to do in the future. And so my challenge to you in this overall concept of environments and behaviour is, how do we deal with unpredictability in moving forward to improve health in Glasgow and Scotland? Very brief, but I hope it made sense. Back to Andrew.
Well, this morning we've had five sets of ideas all together, and we had Phil talking about ethos and civic conversation, and Valerie talking about happiness and simplicity and change just before the break. And here's a summary of the three sets of ideas we've heard since coffee. So, similar format to before coffee, discussion in tables, and I'll draw us back together in about 10 or 15 minutes to see if we can sort of get a summary conversation towards the end. I'd like to not guide you at all, except to say one thing. This time I'd like you, in addition to having a conversation, if you can, or if you feel minded to, or if the spirit takes you, if you could think about what these ideas might mean for practice. Are they useful? Can we turn them into, from being simply interesting ideas, into being useful ideas? Would be my one suggestion. Okay, so I'll draw us back together in 15 minutes. Thank you.